This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Second World War ended 60 years ago, but different versions of history and how that history is taught continue to spark conflict. A few weeks ago, the publication of a controversial textbook in Japan triggered sometimes violent protests in several Chinese cities. Those demonstrations continued this past weekend. Some Japanese businesses have been ransacked. Police stood by as angry crowds pelted the Japanese embassy in Beijing and the consulate in Shanghai with rocks and bottles. The protests come against the backdrop of great power politics and a territorial dispute, but the flashpoint was that middle school history text. It was written by a right-wing nationalist organization and approved by Japan's education ministry. The book leaves out some of the atrocities committed by Japanese troops during the Second World War, including the use of Korean comfort women as sex slaves and germ warfare in China. The textbook does refer to the systematic killing of more than 300 Chinese civilians in Nanking, but downgrades the massacre to an incident. Today we'll talk about rising tensions between Japan, China, and South Korea, and how other countries teach the still sensitive issues of the Second World War. If you have questions about how this history is taught in the U.S. and Europe, as well as in the Far East, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll talk with one of the passengers who was aboard the cruise ship that ran into that enormous rogue wave in the Atlantic Ocean this past weekend, and we'll have your letters. But first, we're joined by Eric Hagenbotham, a senior fellow of Asian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much, Neil. Pleasure to be here.
This new Japanese textbook is just one of several things that are rankling Chinese and Korean leaders. Tell us a little bit first about this territorial dispute, some tiny islands in the East China Sea that are thought to be above very large reserves of oil and gas.
Right. There are a couple of territorial disputes. One is a set of islands, as you said, a very small set of islands that's just off Taiwan, also just off Japan's Ryukyu island chain to the south. There's also a dispute about how to draw the line down the middle or not down the middle of the East China Sea, as the case may be, and about how to exploit and how to divide the profits on exploitation of oil fields that straddle the line.
The other issue that is in the background of these disturbances in China is proposed reform of the United Nations Security Council and Japan's bid to become a permanent member. Of course, China is already, just last week, Chinese leadership said, no, Japan will not be a member of the Security Council.
Right. And you can look at this in one of two ways. There is a longstanding rivalry between Japan and China. This is the first time both of these countries have been strong. In the past, historically, one or the other has been weaker, the other has been stronger. Today, we have a rising China and, of course, an economically quite powerful Japan. Japan wants to join the UN Security Council, and China has qualms about that. A second way of looking at this, or at least one variation, is that Japan is seeking to play a more assertive global role. It's dispatched troops, of course, to Iraq and ships off Afghanistan to the Indian Ocean. At the same time that, from the Chinese perspective, the government and the country is backsliding on historical issues.
And the other country involved in this set of issues, and again, this goes back to that history textbook, is Korea.
Right. And again, there are territorial issues left over from the Second World War also between Korea and Japan. And the Koreans are as excised, sometimes more excised, about Japan's treatment of history as the Chinese are. So that this week, of course, in the U.S. media, demonstrations in China, which in fact were quite dramatic, got the bulk of the news. But the South Koreans also dispatched a team of legislators to protest Japan's treatment of history and demand an explanation from the Japanese government.
So a lot going on in the background. The spark, though, a textbook that, as I understand it, is now being used in 18 Japanese middle schools.
Well, the blow up here is really about a round of approvals by the Ministry of Education of a series of textbooks. There are any number of textbooks being approved all at the same time. They're going through their approval process. this new Japanese history, the one that's so controversial, it was written by the Japanese Society for History Textbook Reform. It is a right-wing revisionist organization. The first version of this textbook was approved in 2001, and that version already glossed over quite a bit of history, portrayed Japanese aggression during World War II as largely a response to European colonialism, an effort to free Asia from colonialism, and ignored a lot of the details of Japanese misbehavior. Now we're going through a second round here. The second version of this book, which many say is worse than the first, has been approved, as have a number of other textbooks. And the concern is that, broadly speaking, this round has approved a set of textbooks that are worse, or at least overlook more details than those in the past.
Now, relations between Japan and China seem to be at a low point. The foreign ministers met over the weekend and did not seem to come away with very nice things or even very diplomatic things to say about their conversations. I think China is a scary country came out at one point. And these demonstrations are clearly, some say, being instigated by the government, at least being tolerated by the government, which is very wary of demonstrations of any sort. If they're going on at all, they're going on with the knowledge and approval of the government.
Right. In this specific set of demonstrations, it would be hard to say, I think, that they were instigated by the government. There is quite a broad anger at Japan for its treatment of history. This really goes back to 2001 when Koizumi began annual visits to Yasukuni.
That's the Shinto shrine,
right,
where war criminals are buried.
War criminals, among others. And just to put this in perspective, this is not some ancient history that's simply static. Class A war criminals were actually enshrined there in a midnight ceremony, a secret ceremony in 1978. They haven't been there since 1946 or 1947. So this history is very much alive, and it's very much a political issue as well as simply a historical issue.
Eric Higginbotham, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Eric Higginbotham is a senior fellow of Asian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. With us now is Franziska Zerafim, an assistant professor of history at Boston College. She's at the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Nice of you to join us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Has there ever been a national consensus in Japan over its Second World War history?
No, definitely not. The question of war memory is highly debated, has always been highly debated, and continues to be very, very political, just as much as it is in China. Specifically, the textbook problem has a very long history in Japan, and it began actually in the late 40s, but then continued in 1965 with the first textbook lawsuit that was brought against the Ministry of Education by Ienaga Saburo, a history teacher, who was trying to put out his own textbook. But what is important here is, on the one hand, a switch from a usually an attack against the government from the left, liberal side, and Ienaga represents that, very well organized, by the way, not just one single lone figure here. Right now, in the 90s, in the latter part of the 90s, really the attack coming from the right, from this new group, the Tsukurukai, that's very much one thing. But the other thing to mention is that this whole textbook controversy in Japan is not only bound up with the content of history textbooks, in other words, what you say and what you don't say, but very much with the whole structure of standardized education, the process through which textbooks get approved, which is more centralized than in other countries, including Germany, but also has shifted over time. This centralization process really took off in the 50s and became institutionalized in 1963. And it's very much a backlash against that, that these lawsuits were brought against the government, and they continued until 97. So we're talking about 32 years, I guess, of textbook lawsuits. And it's really deeply bound up with the domestic struggle over post-war democracy and how that functions.
Domestic struggle in Japan. There is also domestic politics at play in China, is there not?
Of course. And in many ways, I see this particular round of international controversy as really less about Japan's past than it is than about China's present and future. You know, in January, a high Chinese official said that this year's 60th anniversary of the end of World War II is, for China, an invaluable diplomatic asset. Those are strong words.
Let's get some listeners in the conversation. We're talking about teaching history, particularly the history of the Second World War. 800-989-8255. Adam joins us on the line from Caldwell, Idaho.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment that I kind of don't blame the Chinese for feeling the way they do. At the end of the Second World War, and we had victory in Germany, there were the Nuremberg trials, and people were had an answer for their actions. There was no such goings-on at the end of the Pacific War.
There were war crimes in both trials in both Tokyo and also in the Philippines.
But there wasn't this as much of a deal made out of it, and it was not pursued as vigorously as it was. There was thousands of people put to death when the planes ditched from the Doolittle raid on Tokyo.
Professor, please go ahead.
I would say that, of course, there's absolutely no question about Japanese extraordinary brutality in that war. But to belittle the Tokyo war crimes trials and the many, many, I mean, about 1,000 other war crimes trials that were carried out by various victim nations of Japan all across Asia is also not entirely correct historically speaking, but it does say something about our memory of the war. And this gets us into another sort of sphere of this debate. Why is it that these war crimes trials are so poorly remembered, whereas Nuremberg is always held up as the big model here? But it's not true that these war crimes were not persecuted at all.
Adam, thanks very much for the phone call. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the history of World War II, how governments tell that story, and how those lessons are taught. Inadvertently, I may have contributed to the sparks. I said that 300 had been killed in the massacre at Nanking. Of course, it was 300,000. I apologize for the error. Our guest is Franziska Zerafim, Assistant Professor of History at Boston College, and she's with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Joseph. Joseph is calling from Groton, Connecticut.
Yeah, hi, Neil. I have a question for your guest here. If the Japanese have done all sorts of horrible things like the Nanjing massacre, why don't they try to make the Chinese government apologize for what it did? For instance, the Chinese government in the 20th century has killed more Chinese with the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution than probably all the invasions China ever suffered.
Yeah, yes, Professor Zerafim, the Japanese officials have said that they feel it's somewhat ironic to be lectured on this point by the Chinese.
Well, you are right. And, you know, if you look at numbers, and I often find myself quoting that, but in some ways it's also beside the point, in the sense that the Chinese did that to themselves, not to others. What I think is more important to look at, and this is something I'm trying to formulate, I'm not entirely clear on this yet, and the comparison with Germany comes in here, is by stressing today, by China stressing Japanese culpability in World War II today, it also is very silent about precisely the atrocity it committed in the post-war period. You know, we are talking about not just one past here, but several pasts, and they're overlapping. In Germany this summer, in May, actually, the unveiling of this humongous memorial in the center of Berlin near the Brandenburger Tor, in some ways also institutionalizes once again a particular West German way of looking at this past. And at the same time, it's not allowing a much, much smaller exhibition near there to commemorate East Germans dying, trying to escape to the West. There is quite a bit of hegemonic discourse going on here in Germany at the moment, which I think is relevant to the Chinese case, a kind of way of looking back to World War II to not have to deal with something more complicated and more recent, and that is the post-war history.
Joseph, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's follow up on that point. Joining us now is Falk Pingel, Deputy Director of the Georg Eckert Institute for International Textbook Research. And he joins us now on the phone from his home in Braunschweig in Germany. Thanks very much for being with us this evening.
Yeah, hello.
What guidelines, I wonder, do you use to measure bias in history textbooks?
I mean, we are dealing by a multilateral project, bringing together experts, textbook experts, and educationalists from different countries to discuss with them a difficult past, contested issues in history, and to work out recommendations for textbook authors and ministries of education on how to deal with these contested issues. For example, we had in the 70s a German-Polish textbook commission set up, which analyzed almost the whole German-Polish relationship from the Middle Ages up to the present and issued recommendations to be followed by textbook authors in both countries and to deliver a new version of Polish-German relationship in textbooks.
And so by examining such methods, you can arrive at consensus, but
very often, sometimes not. I mean, we started after the Second World War with projects where, on the one hand, the German side was involved and, on the other hand, mostly other European states. Now we are often asked to join projects where Germany is not very much involved as a historical partner, like we are counseling an Israeli-Palestinian group, trying to find a version dealing with the most recent Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which could be dealt with in classroom of both nations.
And I wonder, obviously, in this country, textbooks are chosen either by, boards of local boards of education or state boards of education. We heard earlier about how Japan has somewhat centralized this selection process. How is it done in other countries?
I mean, that's very diverse. There are a lot of countries who still have a centralized education system and also centralized procedures of textbook approval, also in all Europe, like, for example, Greece or Turkey, which is hotly debated at the very moment because the Turkish textbook history and civics textbooks have to be revised if Turkey really wants to join the European Union. On the other hand, there are countries like Great Britain, to a certain extent, also Germany or Italy, or the United States, who have a regionalized textbook approval system. Sometimes the ministries decides, very often like in Germany or in Great Britain, the schools have the most important say. That means the teachers, sometimes even the parents or the representatives of the students' body are involved.
Okay, let's get some more listeners involved in the conversation. Peter is with us from San Rafael, California.
Oh, good afternoon, Neil. I'd like to comment on the absolute lack of adequate history textbooks for use in the United States in junior and senior high schools. I remember at the end of the war, 1945, the country simply turned away. I was a small child at the time. But the country simply turned away from our World War II ally, China, in favor of Japan. And frankly, since 1945 until 1997, with the publication of Iris Chang's book, The Rape of Nanking, American students learned absolutely nothing about the Asian Holocaust, which in every dimension far exceeds the European Holocaust. I'd also like to recommend a recent book by Professor Peter Lee of Rutgers University, War Crimes of the Japanese, which explores this history and fills in a lot of blanks for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Francisca Zerafim, is he right about American history textbooks, as far as you know?
As far as I know, he has a strong point here, and I'm glad he said it rather than me. I don't think one can say that the Nanjing Massacre far exceeds the European Holocaust. The Nanjing Massacre happened very much in the context of war and of, you know, taking a city. Not that that excuses anything, but I think it doesn't compare with a premeditated, institutionalized, organized genocide of the Jews. So I think we need to keep, you know, that a little bit in perspective.
I think that's quite correct. I meant to suggest that the entire actions of the Japanese Imperial Army far exceed the European Holocaust. Some 30 to 35 million Chinese unarmed civilians were massacred in germ warfare experiments conducted by the Japanese military. Hundreds of thousands of Korean and Chinese young women and children, really, were forced into sexual slavery as comfort women. And whereas everyone in this country has heard about the European Holocaust, I do believe that victims of the Asian Holocaust deserve as much recognition as victims of the European Holocaust.
Peter,
I couldn't agree more.
thank you for the call, Peter.
You're welcome.
Let's go now to Pasha. Pasha is with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
I'm half Korean. I was born in Wonju, South Korea. My grandfather was imprisoned in an internment camp by the Japanese, and my grandmother was a very young comfort girl in the same housed in the same elementary school that that she had been attending as a very young girl. And of course, there's a conflict now between the Chinese and the Japanese. I was wondering if there was any Korean reaction in any way, shape, or form, or if they're just kind of staying out of the way.
Well, Francisca Zerafim, I have read of demonstrations in Korea against this Japanese textbook, specifically for the omission of the mention of the comfort women.
Yes, and this has been ongoing. In fact, when this round, this latest round of very publicly debating the history of, and also the memory of this war, really began in 1991, and it was really the comfort women issue, and it was Korea that was behind this. In some ways, you know, Korean Japanese relations are at a slightly different place, I would at least like to think. The Koreans and Japanese are also celebrating this year the 40th anniversary of their friendship and treaty, of their bilateral treaty conducted in 1965. So it's been interesting actually to watch Korea also come to terms with its own skeletons in the closet here. And that includes collaboration, that includes the fact that most post-war Korean leaders, especially the earlier generation of dictators, were very much Japanese trained. So there are very clear linkages and very troubling linkages between the war and the post-war in South Korea that need to be addressed and that are being addressed now, but that used to be sort of pushed away by this very clear anti-Japanese stance of Korean nationalism. But this is much more complicated today.
Mm-hmm. Falk, Pingle,
could I come in here?
Yes, I was just going to ask you to join, yes.
Discussion. I mean, the problem here is, so far, the whole debate is a political issue. It's instigated by the politicians, and the solution is to be expected to come from the politicians. But, in fact, it would be better if we could handle the whole issue as a pedagogical and scientific issue, because it deals with how students, pupils, 14 years old, should learn about history, mm-hmm. and not what on the political level is debated. For this very moment, the history is misused for political aims. so long as the Chinese government is not ready to talk about their own crimes, so long as they're not open to discuss the Chinese-Japanese relationship, or even to take into account for the presentation of the Second World War in their own textbook, recent research that has been done in the United States or in Europe for an updated, unbiased version of the history of the Second World War in their textbooks, it's not on, I would say it's not the right way to deal with the subject, because students, pupils are concerned and not politicians.
Pasha, thank you very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about teaching the history of the Second World War. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Falk Pingle, Franziska Zerafima mentioned an interesting word a moment ago, and that is collaboration. I wonder, do history textbooks in countries like France or Norway deal with collaboration during the Second World War?
I mean, that is always a very difficult issue. And all the textbooks in all the European countries who fought against the Nazi system started with eulogizing the resistance and more or less neglecting cooperation during, say, about the first 10 to 15 years after the war. Now it's different. The latest textbook issued in the 90s up to now in France, for example, also deal with collaboration, with lawsuits against those one who were joined the Nazi SS and helped to deliver the Jews to the SS and so on. But that took a very long time.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is John from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yes, sir.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I grew up in the Philippines right after the war. I knew girls that were kidnapped off the street and were used as comfort women. I knew a woman whose daughter was my age who had been snatched off the street for use as a comfort woman, and she committed no crime except she was beautiful. And my parents visited or attended many of the war crimes trials, and, you know, there's a lot that isn't being told. I visit Japan on a regular basis now, and the first time I went there, I went to this high school, and the Japanese history teacher told me, he said, John, I can't tell my students the truth. I can't tell them anything that's not in the ministry-approved textbook. Said, but I'm going to ask you to sit down in this room on the ground floor each afternoon, and I'm going to tell tell teachers and students that you're there. And they would come and ask me questions, and I spent 3 hours crying each afternoon as I answered their questions, and the memories came back to haunt me. And the Japanese people had never heard or had been told that whatever they had heard was not true. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Professor Zerafim to comment for a moment on what's lost if history is misrepresented.
Well, obviously a lot is lost, but the more important point here is who is to, how we evaluate how much all Japanese people know. We have to break this down. If one teacher says he is constrained by the Ministry of Education, it might very well be true at a certain time, also a particular kind of school. But teachers in Japan over this long time span of now 60 years have actually found this terrain shifting in great ways. And given that this particular textbook, when it was first approved in 2001, was adopted by 1% of all schools, teachers who have been represented very powerfully by the Japan Teachers Union, a very left, radical, highly anti-government organization, that has fought for this and has put out their own texts, I think it's highly misleading to say that no Japanese know anything about the war.
John, thank you for the phone call. We're going to continue our discussion about World War II history after a short break, plus a cruise ship encounters some really high seas and your letters. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's continue our discussion about how history of the Second World War gets written. Our guests are Franziska Zerfim, Assistant Professor of History at Boston College, and Falk Pingel, Deputy Director of the Georg Eckert Institute for International Textbook Research. And I wanted to read an email that we got from Jamie. Can the guests comment on the differences in the way Germany and Japan have remembered their country's respective war crimes at the level of their political leadership? For example, in Germany, high-level acts of contrition are well known. Willy Brandt kneeling at the Warsaw Ghetto Monument or the Holocaust Memorial at the center of the capital. I wonder if such acts are missing at the highest political and cultural level in Japan. Professor Zerafin?
That's obviously a very good point. It's something that comes up all the time. But it also, the question itself presupposes that these things need to be done at a state level, at an official level. And there needs to be a particular kind of symbolism that accompanies such acts of apology or contrition or whatever you want to call this. There's no doubt that Germany has become a master of this kind of official symbolic acts for international consumption. And it's also undeniable that Japan has not done this kind of thing very well, which is not to say the Japanese don't remember the war. They remember it differently. And there's a particular reason also, and it's a historical one, why this never developed in the same way. I think it's quite true that for the most part, the state has left the negotiation of war memory to the participants of domestic political contention. It's part of the struggle over post-war democracy. It has left that contention to civil organizations, to representatives of special interests, to citizen movements, to self-acclaimed opponents to the state who used war memory to further their own interests and aims. But you have yet to really look at how this worked in Germany on that particular level.
Would you care to comment on that, Falk Pingel?
Yeah. The situation in Europe was quite different, in particular Germany's situation or Germany's role in the recovery, economic and social recovery in Europe after the Second World War. Reconciliation was needed because Germany should become a partner in the European Economic Community. So the relation to the former so-called enemy countries must be built on a new basis. And this concept of a larger economic social unit did not exist in the Asian context. China was a communist country, Korea was divided, and also there was a lot of cooperation in the last 20 years between Korea and Japan, but not that kind of a political social unit like the EU. So it was for Japan easier to neglect its responsibility as far as the history is concerned. And there might be another issue involved, that Japan tried to play a leading, first of all, a leading economic role in Asia and to lead economic cooperation. And it was not aware that that must be supported by cultural cooperation. And I guess that in the future, the Japanese government will become aware that it cannot play a leading economic role without giving more attention to cultural cooperation.
Let's get one last caller in. Mike. Mike's calling from Cottage Grove in Minnesota.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is basically about generational perception of the history of the Second World War. My father was a U.S. soldier in the Philippines and fought against the Japanese, but my in-laws were Japanese making planes and stuff in Nagoya. They were young teenagers working in the factories. I've talked to my father-in-law about the war, and I asked him about Nanking, and he basically, his perception is that this is Chinese propaganda. When I've talked to my wife about the war, she realizes these things are written in Western history, but she kind of downplays that, and the suffering of the bombings where, like in Nagoya, where my in-laws were, that seems to be more prevalent in their perception of the history of World War II and more important. And I was wondering what this generational perception and how this is affecting the politics in Asia as far as Chinese, Japanese, Korean, you know, all this working together, the perception of generations and how they affect the policy in Japan and how the other countries are perceiving that. I don't know if it's documented or if this is just something from my personal family history, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Franziska Serafin? Hello? Hello, Franziska Serafin. And we may have lost our line to WBUR in Boston, and we apologize for that. I wonder, Falk Pingel, are you still with us?
Yeah. I think it's quite clear. It cannot be doubted that the Japanese army committed a massacre in Nanjing. There is some debate about the numbers of victims, whether more or less than 300,000, but approximately. But the issue is that the Chinese government does not open its archives to foreign scholars to study in depth what happened during the Second World War on Chinese territory. So they still use this as an argument against China, but not opening up a dialogue between the two former enemies to come support joint research projects and develop maybe joint educational guidelines. They still use their own arguments without taking into account the other side.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your time today. Falk Pingel is deputy director of the Georg Eckert Institute for International Textbook Research, and we'd also like to thank Franziska Serafin, assistant professor of history at Boston College. Are you back with us?
I hope so.
Oh,
I don't
there
know.
You are. I apologize. Certainly whatever went wrong was probably our fault and nothing to do with you, but we did want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, too.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.